Welcome to episode 304 of the Microsoft Cloud IT Pro Podcast, recorded live on October 14th, 2022. This is a show about Microsoft 365 and Azure from the perspective of IT pros and end users, where we discuss a topic or recent news and how it relates to you. It's Techtober, and we're continuing to fundraise for Girls Who Code. Check out the show notes for a link to help us with the fundraiser. In this episode, we start diving into announcements and updates from Ignite, ranging from our overall opinion of the show and the future of Ignite, to updates around Azure CLI and Azure PowerShell, as well as the removal of Azure Classic Resource Providers. From there, we move into talking about the rename of Office to Microsoft 365, and the fact that Office 365 and Microsoft 365 are both still around in still products. And then we wrap up talking about authentication strength and the preview of this feature in Azure AD Conditional Access. We have a whole crew of people here, all anxious to hear all about Ignite, because Ignite is top of everybody's mind right now. Did you see, speaking of Ignite, the dates for next year were announced?
I did see that.
The only place
November
I've seen it, though?
Something. Yeah. It's late, though, like November 16.
16, 17, 13, 14. The only place I've seen it, I don't know if Microsoft's put anything official out there. I saw it on Twitter.
Yes.
From Vlad.
There were people posting pictures.
Yeah, our good friend Vlad is who I saw it from. But the only part that bummed me out about it was, I don't mind November. I don't know. I didn't see a location for it in November, but it was 2 days. I do remember that, which means it's not November 15, 16. Here it is. Save the date. November 15, 16, 2023 is going to be Ignite, aka.ms/igniteinfo. To be the first to know when registration opens. The only part that bums me out, it's only 2 days, which means we're not back to the full week-long Ignite that we used to. It'll be interesting to see if it's still smaller and they keep it in Seattle or what the location is, but I was a little bummed that it appears not to be back to normal Ignite yet.
Yeah, I think it's going to be different for some time. What did I see? I thought I saw something on Twitter that like registration, you know how registration this year was the weird hybrid, in-person, all that kind of thing?
Yep.
That registration was capped at a fairly low number of people. I think like that proved to be true. Like there was another conference actually going on at the Seattle Conference Center at the time.
Okay.
Which in the past, you could easily eat up that entire conference center with just Ignite, and that wasn't happening. So attendees being capped at just a couple thousand for in-person drives you to almost like the Seattle event is just another regional event. It maybe just happens to have some additional gravity because there's a bunch of PMs in Seattle and kind of developers there and things that can come and interact with customers and get all that going. But, you know, there were also regional events around the world for this one. So I know Manchester was one over in the UK. There were like five or six other ones that were spun up as smaller in-person events as well. I think you're just seeing the overall like road showification of Ignite. Like we used to have Ignite and then we'd have Ignite the tour.
Right.
Now you kind of get like fall Ignite, spring Ignite kinds of things. And they're just all up smaller shows, geo distributed, some things recorded, some things potentially not recorded. You know, your mileage may vary there depending on what you wanted to see or interact with. It is just kind of, I think, the new normal there. Another interesting thing I noticed about Ignite this year, just based on like feedback of folks who went in person, like beyond being a more low-key event, you know, it was one of those things that strikes me as like, wow, it's different times, is no swag. So no backpacks, no water bottles, anything like that, which I know like my kids walk around with a whole big pile of those backpacks from past Ignites. Like every year when they run out of their backpack, I'm like, yeah, you ruined that one. Here's the next one out of the closet. Have fun, kids.
Yeah.
So no backpacks, no sweatshirts, no battery packs, anything like that.
Yeah. It's going to be really interesting to see what comes out of it over the next few years, if it ever goes back to a full week long, or if it continues to be shorter, more recorded, and like you said, it turns into a little bit of a roadshow, multiple events, or if they try to expand how they do satellite locations, where they have a whole bunch of different locations, and they have some people in person and they have some things recorded and maybe even sponsor satellite locations. I don't know. It will be, I'm really curious to see kind of if it ever goes back to the full 5 day. I miss it. Like, I loved 20,000 people, big event, being able to see everybody, but I don't know. Don't know.
Yep. The cynic in me says, don't hold out hope there.
That's kind of my thought as well. That is a very interesting comment. So Torek just said in the chat, as Microsoft podcasters, you should be there. I absolutely agree, Torek. Scott and I, if you go back and find some of our old shows from pre-COVID, we used to be able to go. Like, we could participate in some of the media stuff as podcasters, and we would absolutely go to Ignite, podcast live from there, almost get to cover the show kind of like other media would. Like, we ran into people from The Verge and from the different tech media places in the past. They still do have some type of media stuff, but it's all been virtual. And we looked at doing in-person stuff, and there just wasn't a good opportunity to be out there without spending a bunch of our own money this year. And I looked at it. I almost registered. I couldn't swallow the cost for it this year with only 2 days. And I think that's my biggest challenge with this is 2 days. Reality is, even being in the States, it ends up being about a $4,000 to $5,000 investment to go. Not to mention, I don't get to work for 2 days. And it's a significant investment as an independent consultant for me to get out there, especially for only 2 days. And when I don't get to interact with a lot of people due to the virtual nature of it and the smaller audience. That's just me, straightforward, frankly, my opinion, perspective on it.
Yeah, I think the all-up media strategy was interesting this year. So in the past, there has been kind of on-site media. And this year, a lot of that didn't happen. So I think lots of folks that you might look to, who I think of as kind of just, you know, really solidly in the Microsoft news space, like somebody like Mary J. Foley, writing for ZDNet, Paul Throw, things like that, like even they didn't attend in person. So, you know, like I was kind of catching up on how some of the other media organizations were doing that. So like Mary J. Foley had a really good, I'll see if I can put a link in Discord and in the show notes, a really good interview with Scott Gu from kind of Cloud and AI and Azure. But that was all done remote over Teams. And basically the transcript of that was was just published up on ZDNet. So it's weird. It's different. We'll see how it grows in the future kinds of thing.
Yeah.
I too miss the before times, but I'm trying my best to adapt to the new times rather.
Yeah. And we're going to have to figure out some of the whole media stuff too, in terms of maybe trying to get some of those interviews if it does stay remotely and all of that. And yeah, I agree, Torg. Like, that's the big struggle with it. So Torg just said the M365 collab for 5 days is only $1,800 in Vegas. And that is, like, even Ignite in the past for the full 5 days has been, it's been a little more, but it's only been like 24-ish, I believe, 22 to 24. So having it right around $2,000 for just 2 days, it seemed expensive to me. We'll see. It's possible too, with a smaller conference, some of your expenses don't go away, and that they had to charge more to still cover their costs. I don't know. I don't know what sponsors are either. Lower sponsor numbers, attendees had to pay more. There's a whole bunch of things that go into the cost of these conferences that we never are see or are privy to. So that is Ignite. But there was also news from Ignite, Scott. There were new features, deprecated features, interesting product renames.
All sorts of stuff, yeah. So we talked about some product deprecations last week in the form of things like basic load balancer, kind of getting that out the door, potentially thinking like longer term about resources that, hey, these things are going away. Unmanaged disks was the other one that we talked about.
Yep.
One that kind of slipped through and I missed, which I think is potentially bigger than both of those, is the Azure Classic resource providers are all going to be retired August 31, 2024. And that is all of the classic resource providers that fall under ASM. So sure, unmanaged disks go away. You can do unmanaged disks under ARM, under ASM. You know, maybe you're doing one or the other. Like, think about it. It's 3 years out. This is a little bit shorter. And I know absolutely, like I still work with customers today who have a surprising footprint in ASM and classic when it kind of comes down to it and what that looks like. And when I say the resource provider is going away, the entire provider endpoint is going away. So like we have like management.azure.com today for ARM as just like the REST API endpoint to interact with that. All of ASM, the endpoint is going to be shut down. It's going to be disabled, no more access, totally revoked. So if you have any automation built around that, you're potentially using classic tooling, you just haven't updated along the way, you have to go ahead and come over to ARM. Now, that doesn't mean that necessarily the classic resource goes away. Like there's this weird quasi world where you can potentially manage classic-ish things through ARM. So I think about something like cloud services. So there's cloud services classic, which, you know, still resides in ASM. And then there's this whole new like cloud services extended support thing, which technically runs up under the ARM moniker and it's kind of all ready to go over there. So I think this one's potentially much bigger. Like it's something that, you know, most organizations, like I think if you're using classic in a quote unquote meaningful way, you really have to think about resourcing and other things to get this one over the fence and get it fixed before it does go away. You know, I call it out because I know, again, I'm working with customers today where we're going in and we're saying like, hey, you should really think about doing like blah, blah, blah. And they're coming back and going, you know, we're 2 years into a global pandemic, we're resource constrained, the whole, you know, macroeconomic environment that we've got going on globally here, it's a little messed up. You know, stock market's down, layoffs, like we just don't have resources to get these things done, either people, vendors, money, whatever it happens to be. So yeah, it's like get in front of it kind of thing. The writing's on the wall, you know, classic needs to go away. It's a bigger precursor to things like RDFE and all the like Red Dog front end stuff, all that clearing out as well. So I'll pour one out when it goes away, but I won't be sad to see it go.
Yeah, I won't either. I'm surprised there's as much of it around as there still is from that classic environment. And I guess I get it. I'm coming at it from my perspective, small business. I haven't worked with any clients that have massive investments into Azure, but you do. You think about clients that maybe put 2,000-4,000 VMs in Azure 4 or 5 years ago. That's not an insignificant footprint to convert from classic resources to ARM-based resources.
Yeah, it's not inconsequential. A couple of other things I think that are changing, and this was announced at Ignite kind of in a wider context. I think there's lots of us out there that use kind of Azure native tooling, things like we don't all just go and use the REST API. We potentially go out and, you know, we use PowerShell, the CLI, things like that.
Yep.
Just to, you know, line everything up and get it to where it needs to be. Both PowerShell and the CLI had some announcements at Ignite. Hey, here's some new features that are coming in, things that you might want to, in general, think about, like, you know, here's some nifty new stuff you can take advantage of. Something that was new to me, and I completely missed this one too, so maybe it slid in under the radar someplace else, is that both PowerShell and CLI kind of now have these twice a year breaking change releases. And at Ignite, it just happened to be that for both PowerShell and the CLI, the releases that were announced there and that are landing kind of post-build fall under that breaking change release cycle. If you are someone who not only uses this tooling, but you try and kind of do the right thing and keep up to date with it, it might be good to go out and kind of grab the docs, which are published on docs.ms. I guess it's learn.microsoft.com. We should talk about the whole docs to learn rebrand.
Oh, we could definitely talk about this.
At some point that's out there. So theoretically, easier for customers to consume, you know, hey, here's a single doc with all the upcoming breaking changes, things like that. But it's also just more cognitive load, more for folks to think about as they're kind of consuming these tools and, you know, opting to use them in their environments.
So I'm guessing that this twice a year breaking changes is intentional breaking changes. This does not give them or they're not giving us any promise that other updates aren't going to have unintentional breaking changes.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. So this is an opportunity, you know, if you think about just from like an SDLC perspective or an SDL perspective, like, yep. Hey, here's how Microsoft can have a model to introduce net new functionality that fundamentally changes perhaps the way some of this tooling works. And I think people have looked at that, like, you know, there's been some wonky things. Like I remember, you know, during like the early days of PowerShell, where sometimes you would have a proper PowerShell object for something that was returned. Sometimes you would have like just a big blob of, you know, like, oh, here's some incoming JSON from the ARM API that you had to then go and parse and do something with yourself. So I can certainly like understand like why they would want to do some of these things. And, you know, it is in spirit of moving things forward, but I just think from a customer perspective, right? Like potential cognitive load, think about it. It is something that's coming up and that now, again, like, hey, you know, just keep this in the back of your head as you're doing things. Like if I'm going to be deploying a new PowerShell release and we're going to be like standardizing on that, right? Like, say you're an MSP and within your org, you write a bunch of scripts for your customers and those are shared out and they're ready to go. Like, you know, it's just more vetting that needs to be done there. I don't think it's a bad thing. It's more like, hey, you got to spend some time here. Like it's worth spending the cycles to figure this out.
Yeah, definitely. I missed that whole announcement as well around that breaking change release cycle. So that's interesting. I wonder if they're going to do that for all of the, is this just Azure? I'm assuming this doesn't apply to like the Graph PowerShell and all of those. Did they?
So far, I've only noticed this for Azure.
For Azure. Okay.
And specifically for the CLI and PowerShell. I haven't seen it for other client tools. You know, there's been some new client tooling released lately. Like, I don't know if you've seen anything with the Azure Developer CLI. So, you know, we have like AZ CLI. There's actually a whole Azure Developer CLI, which is nothing like the Azure CLI. It's a little bit of a kind of a weird beast, but I didn't catch anything in there. There's no upcoming breaking changes documentation there. There's nothing like that I've seen for Graph or any of like the Microsoft 365, Office 365 PowerShell commandlets, nothing like that.
Got it.
But I mean, with Graph, most of the time you're going against a REST API anyway. So good luck with what's working, what version of which API you're supposed to be using and all that anyway.
Was it? Oh man, I can't remember who I was talking with this about the other day, but the headache was switching to the Graph and the endpoints and the fact that there's still a few commandlets that you need to use MSOL for, the Microsoft Services Online or MS Online module. So there are times when you still need to have Microsoft Online module, Azure AD module, and the Graph module all installed, even though technically we're supposed to be using the Graph for everything.
Yeah, yeah. I think lots of folks look at that and wish it was iterating a lot faster. I can appreciate the messaging, like we should all be using that, but it's really hard when the functionality isn't there. And then it's again, the cognitive load thing, right? It's on me as a potential administrator, somebody who needs to consume those tools and those APIs to figure out what's going to work and what's not going to work there. Like the whole, we're going to put it out in the world and this is going to be our North Star. Like, great. You know, I can get behind that. I don't know that the whole, let's just get it out in the world and then do the fast follow thing, but our stance is going to be that we're only going to tell you it's like the North Star. That's really hard to follow.
Well, and you could also argue that the whole fast follow thing is not very fast.
Yeah, fair enough.
Do you feel overwhelmed by trying to manage your Office 365 environment? Are you facing unexpected issues that disrupt your company's productivity? IntelliJink is here to help. Much like you take your car to the mechanic that has specialized knowledge on how to best keep your car running, IntelliJink helps you with your Microsoft Cloud environment because that's their expertise. IntelliJink keeps up with the latest updates in the Microsoft Cloud to help keep your business running smoothly and ahead of the curve. Whether you are a small organization with just a few users up to an organization of several thousand employees, they want to partner with you to implement and administer your Microsoft Cloud technology. Visit them at intellijnk.com/podcast. That's intellijnk.com/podcast for more information or to schedule a 30-minute call to get started with them today. Remember, IntelliJink focuses on the Microsoft Cloud so you can focus on your business. Do you have any other announcements you would like to discuss, talk about? There were a whole slew of them out there.
There was a whole bunch of stuff. I don't know that like net new service-wise, there was a ton of things that made me go like, ooh, that's really cool. And I'd really like to try that and get hands-on with it. You know, tons of things around confidential compute. I saw Azure Private DNS Resolver GA'd. I think like that's a big win. You know, thinking about kind of some of the headaches with managing private DNS and having to do the whole rigmarole between my on-prem DNS and what's going on in Azure and resolution between on-prem clients, in the cloud clients, who's on the VPN, who's not on the VPN, all those kinds of things. I think that's all really good stuff. There's a couple new preview services out there. One of the ones I want to get my hands on after reading the documentation is ElasticSAN. I don't know if you saw that one, ElasticSAN or CloudSAN, but it's basically, it is what it says on the tin. It's a cloud-based SAN. So provision this logical resource that's called a SAN. Within there, you have a volume group. And then within that volume group, you have logical volumes that are just presented as iSCSI targets that then you can go back and mount to any VM. But I think it's going to be super duper powerful, and like it's going to have some pretty cool use cases. Like it potentially supports upwards of, I don't have the article up in front of me, but it's something like 2 million IOPS in a single volume group. And then you can kind of allocate IOPS in a volume at like 64,000 IOPS per volume. And, you know, so like a couple of weeks ago, we talked about like VMs and potential VM limitations and like disk throughput and things like that.
Yep.
With like a traditional virtual machine and a managed disk, you are potentially bound by network throughput, just kind of raw network throughput, even like within Azure and the network throughput of your VM. CloudSAN somehow, ElasticSAN somehow bypasses that. So you can actually expose a raw iSCSI target over to a VM, and kind of irrespective of the VM limits for say like disk throughput and network throughput, it can actually take advantage of all those IOPS, which is kind of cool. It's on some kind of like FastPath thing.
Got it.
Funny enough, the ElasticSAN folks, they sit in the org I'm at Microsoft. Like I should probably just go find one of them and chat with them about it or try and have them on over here. But it was one of those ones, like I deal with storage customers a lot, right? Like we spend a lot of time talking about throughput in storage accounts. You know, here's logical limits. IOPS is certainly a limiting factor with object storage accounts, data lake storage accounts, disks, all these kinds of things. Like, so when I see things like basically millions of IOPS in single targets, that's like, ooh, we can do some exciting things with that, particularly for larger customers or frankly, anybody who like just wants to pay for that performance and have it. I think that'll all be kind of cool stuff. I'm gonna throw a bomb over your way because we've been talking about some Azure stuff. So like, here comes a grenade over the podcast fence to you. They're also apparently rebranding Office to Microsoft. So there's all, you know, I think there's quite a bit of kind of confusion there. Like Office as a brand, I think, has been an established brand for 30 plus years now.
30?
Something like 30, 32 years that Office has been around since like the earliest days and the earliest releases. And they're kind of getting rid of that. So it's not going to be like Microsoft Office Word. It's going to be Microsoft Word or Microsoft 365 Word. It's like, I don't know how that's all going to bake out kind of thing. I just, you know, marketing aside, like it's going to make it really confusing to find documentation. There's going to all of a sudden be a whole ton of outdated blog posts and things that are out there that are just frankly never going to be fixed. And that potentially, I think, impacts like SaaS services over time too, because it was certainly framed up that way, right? Like watching it in the keynote, kind of, hey, here's this new logo that, you know, nobody was really talking about, but then it's framed by all these desktop services, desktop applications, which also happen to be web applications, which also happen to live within the Microsoft 365 stack or the Office 365 stack, the something 365 stack. So I think that's going to be a, it's going to be something to watch.
You're just trying to be mean. And Torg in the Discord chat is not making this any better for me. Yeah, you're just going to get me to walk away because I'm going to start ranting big time on this. Yes, Office is being renamed to Office 360, not Office 365. Office is being renamed to Microsoft 365. And I'm going to clarify this one because I just saw, so in the chat, Torg, this was not very nice, just said no more Office 365. It is all now Microsoft 365. No, it is not. It is not all Microsoft 365. The rename of this rename was the Office desktop apps are now Microsoft 365. There was a rename 2 years ago. I just did a YouTube video on this, and I will be more than happy to share this, where they rebranded Office 365 as Microsoft 365. This was Office 365 business plans that got renamed to Microsoft 365. But in the past 2 years, everybody has created this fallacy that it was a complete branding rename. And in my YouTube video, I actually outlined some articles going back to 2020 all the way until Ignite, where Ignite, they still talk about this branding rename that happened or this branding change. 9to5 Mac did it, The Verge did it, where Office 365 was rebranded 2 years ago as Microsoft 365. No, it was just small business. So now we still have small business. You have Microsoft 365 business plans. It is just business plans. You have the Office desktop app. I think this is the desktop app. Maybe this is the web app. I know it's mobile apps because it showed up in my mobile app update, where the mobile Office 365 app is now the Microsoft 365 app. However, when you talk enterprise plans, E1, E3, E5, you still have Office 365, E1, E3, and E5, and you still have Microsoft 365, E3, and E5, as two very different products, two very unique products, two very different features included with all of these products. And until Microsoft figures out how to rename those Office 365, E1, E3, and E5 plans, you are still going to have Office 365 and Microsoft 365 as two distinct products. So see, and Microsoft, Torg, you're going to get me going now. Microsoft does this. They talk about the Microsoft 365 E3 bundle. Microsoft 365 E3 bundle is Office 365 E3, Enterprise Mobility and Security E3, and Windows Enterprise. Now it's 11, it was 10, but Windows Enterprise E3. That is what the Microsoft 365 bundle is, as with Office 365 E3 as a part of it. Office 365 E3 is your collaboration apps. It's SharePoint, it's Exchange, it's all of that. EMS is all your security, your MDM, your MAM, all of that. Windows is your Windows license. And they took all of those products and bundled them into Microsoft 365. So that is where a lot of that confusion lies. And yeah, Office 365 is a part of Microsoft 365, but they are still two very distinct products. And I'll throw a link in the show notes to the YouTube video I just published going through all of this, showing all the SKUs, all of that. But that whole message has been lost in the verbiage people are using, in the articles people are writing. I have fallen into the trap, and I've been trying to do a better job at it because it causes confusion as I work with clients because of the different feature sets. When you say you have Microsoft 365, I assume you have one set of features, but if you really only have Office 365, you have a small subset of the greater feature set. So that is my rant, and I feel like this branding of Office to Microsoft 365 when it comes to like the mobile app and I guess potentially desktop apps or web apps is just going to confuse people even more. Because now when you have Microsoft 365, are you talking mobile app? Are you talking desktop app? Are you talking these E3, E5 plans? I don't know. I don't like how they're calling everything Microsoft 365. You can have that global umbrella, but you need to then make it very clear what all these sub-products of the greater Microsoft 365 product are. I'm climbing down off my soapbox.
Yeah. Ooh.
Told you, you threw that grenade over the fence and it just exploded.
I knew what I was doing.
And then Torg threw one too. I got two grenades coming from two different directions.
Yeah. I think it's good that you wish it's going to happen, but those are probably just very strong, very strong wishes at this point.
Yeah. So off of my soapbox now, there was one cool feature. I showed you this one. I'm going to get off that vent and go talk about a feature. Conditional access. We've talked about this before too. They added a new grant control in conditional access that is conditional access authentication strength. I don't know how much we've talked about passwordless in the past, but we've talked about conditional access. We did a video on it talking about how you could use it to require multi-factor authentication. And if you're looking to move from maybe security defaults into multi-factor authentication, conditional access is the way to do it. Now, with all of the passwordless, with some of the phishing stuff in the news too, they have added a new preview feature for authentication strength that allows you, instead of just doing plain old require MFA, you have three different options in here when it comes to requiring authentication strength, where you can do multi-factor authentication, but it has to be a combination of methods that satisfy strong authentication, such as password plus SMS. And then you can also do passwordless MFA, where you're going to force passwordless to satisfy strong authentication, Microsoft Authenticator app, one of that passwordless method. I don't know if Windows Hello may fall on that one as well. And then the final authentication strength you can set is phishing-resistant multi-factor authentication, where you actually force things such as FIDO to security key. So you're going to have to use a USB key now for conditional access, YubiKey. There's a bunch of different vendors out there. YubiKey is just a big one. I know Microsoft partners with them a lot. So this could really come in handy if you want to start pushing employees or pushing people to use stronger authentication methods, pushing them towards passwordless, FIDO 2 keys. Having this in there is, I love that they added this in here.
Yeah. So the way you can think about this is, you know, you mentioned like maybe this one's Windows Hello for Business. So in the portal, they're presented as multi-factor authentication, passwordless, multi-factor authentication, and then you the phishing resistant one. So it's really Windows Hello for Business or FIDO2 security key or Azure AD certificate-based authentication and doing multi-factor that way. So you can kind of think about it as potentially like those three lenses and then where they come in. There's another thing that you potentially need to think about, like if you're looking at this in preview and you're going, ooh, this is going to satisfy everything for all my users, internal, external, those kinds of things. And it is noted in the documentation. The authentication methods that external users use to satisfy those MFA requirements. So you're saying like, hey, I want you to do this, but ultimately that really means it needs to be done through the user's home tenant. They can be different depending on whether that user is actually completing the MFA in their home tenant or in the resource tenant where that conditional access policy is defined. So that can be a little bit of a gotcha there. And not so much a gotcha, but it's more like, hey, let's think through this a little bit before we turn it on. Maybe run it in what if mode and see what it's going to do.
Yes. Always a good thing with conditional access is leverage that what if, or do some reporting for a little bit before you actually just roll it out to everybody. Oh, so we've been going for a little bit today.
Yeah, we have been. Might be time to log off.
Anything else? It might be. There were a bunch of other renames. I felt like this was the Ignite of renames?
There were renames, and I'm sure we can get into all that. But for anybody who's still sticking around, made it this far, you're either listening live or you are, you know, sitting in your car, whatever, things like that. We talked about it last week. I'm going to keep talking about it for the entire month. We're doing a fundraiser for Girls Who Code. So Girls Who Code, for those that don't know, is an organization that sponsors computer science programs for young women, young ladies, young girls, specifically targeting those in like grades 6 through 12. And, you know, that translates all over the world. Like I'm kind of speaking in US context, like, you know, sixth grader, seventh grader, things like that. But it is a worldwide organization. They do some excellent work. We have a forum up on the Girls Who Code site where you can go ahead and give us a donation. I went in last week after we talked about this. I put a little bit in there just to see if we can like snowball it, get it rolling. You know, not to like shame people, but Ben and I see the download numbers for this podcast. We know how many of you there are. If everybody gave just a few dollars, like not a lot, right? Like I'm talking, hey, don't go buy a cup of coffee at Starbucks, you know, this week, $4 or $5, something like that. We would absolutely be able to raise $1,000 pretty quickly. I think that's a pretty kind of conservative goal. And I would love to see our community be able to do something there. So I'll continue to tweet, post in Discord, and generally rant about this for the next month until we get there. And then my offer still stands. So whatever we raise for the podcast, up to $1,000, I'll do that donation myself. And then I'll get that matched by Microsoft, who matches 100%. So we could potentially raise $3,000 in a month. And I think that's a pretty cool thing to do.
Absolutely. We should definitely do it. I will go throw some in as well. I have not talked to my wife about matching anything, so I'm not committing to that yet, but there's a chance I will.
I'm not putting you on the block.
I know you're not.
Absolutely. I am using my employer as a way to make that happen, right? Like I get this benefit as a Microsoft employee in that they will 100% match me up to certain amounts. And this is an amount that happens to fall in there. I have some young girls in my life, like nieces, things like that, who I would love to be able to get into technology someday. Like if they choose to go down that path, I certainly work with a whole bunch of awesome women, you know, across my career and even like today in Microsoft. Like I would love to see that next generation come up. So that's a me thing.
For sure.
I don't feel like you're obligated there.
I do not feel obligated or pressured, but we will definitely do something as well. And you said 1,000, but truth be told, between listener numbers, between matching, all of that, I feel like as a podcast, if you take the cumulative total with all the matching, we should be able to even get closer to $4,000 or $5,000 for Girls Who Code. So that is my stretch goal. I think we should shoot for that $4,000 to $5,000 range.
I love it. All right. So with that being said, I have been on this microphone way too much today, but I got to go chat for another hour on my next meeting. So
all right,
it is into the breach again, I go.
Go enjoy your meetings.
Yep. Always a pleasure, Ben. Thanks.
Absolutely. We'll talk to you later, Scott. If you enjoyed the podcast, go leave us a 5-star rating in iTunes. It helps to get the word out so more IT pros can learn about Office 365 and Azure. If you have any questions you want us to address on the show or feedback about the show, feel free to reach out via our website, Twitter, or Facebook. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.